And we're live with our 288th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Ken and I are excited, as always, to be back. We're running a couple minutes behind today. We're just commiserating on, you know, AI for focused tooling and how to actually make that work within pipelines this morning. And we will have some discussion on that around on the podcast today. There's a couple of articles that have popped up about the best use and how people are starting to rework their security pipelines using, you know, using generative AI. And obviously we have training and other things that are associated with that. But so we're running a little bit behind today. That being said, we did want to highlight the fact that we have a couple of training opportunities coming up for Absolute AppSec. And the first one is in July, July 17th and 18th. We will be teaching Practical Secure Code Review, the AI-enhanced version of Practical Secure Code Review. And this is an opportunity for you as a developer, as a security engineer, to improve your manual secure code review process and to enhance that using AI tooling and generative AI. Ken and I have been working on this course for, or we have taught this course for 6 years, 7 years, 8 years at this point. And it is the process. Yeah, it's the process that we use on a daily basis to perform secure code reviews, to find flaws in code. And it is a proven methodology that will help you focus your efforts when you're doing a secure code review. The AI portions of this are awesome. I don't think there's any other way to get around that. Just it makes you so much more efficient. So having the framework, having the methodology in place with the AI portions and the use of generative AI, whether that is Ollama, whether that is Claude, some of the, you know, the commercial models that are out there, it basically feels like a superpower if you've done code review in the past, because it does make you so much more efficient. So come sign up. The opportunity to sign up is at training.absoluteappsec.com. We'd love to have you. We've got multiple people in this course, but would love to add a few more before it happens next month. So that
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, I was going to step on to the, you know, the harnessing LLMs course as well from DEF CON. But did you want to say something else to Practical Secure Code Review?
No, because I'm going to follow up. But yeah, the DEF CON course, I think, is very interesting. Sorry.
It is. And that one has evolved quite a bit. I think the last time we taught harnessing LLMs was a virtual course 3 months ago or so. And things have evolved since then. The course at that point was very heavy on the secure code review side. We've been using LLMs on the dynamic side. You've got things like Burp AI that have been introduced, the ability to use MCP servers for multiple security tools and use AI tools, agentic AI, to actually make your life easier as a product security AppSec, you know, engineer or consultant. There are so many opportunities there to actually speed up your process. And one of the articles we're going to talk about today, you know, feeds directly into that, right? But training.defcon.org is where you can sign up to that. You can also find the link to both courses at training.absoluteappsec.com. So if you are looking to upscale your application security knowledge and expertise through the use of AI or through new methodologies, we'd love for you to consider, you know, our trainings for that purpose. Yeah, Ken, what else did you have to say to our trainings?
Yeah, it just brought up an interesting like conversation I had on LinkedIn, because you and I got tagged in a post about our manual review code course. part saying, you know, like, yeah, praising it. But the other part was about how, you know, in this AI vibe coded world, manual coding skills, you know, or it was kind of a question of like, where does it go with manual, you know, review skills? And I was going to ask you, like, do you feel that with as much code is being generated through, you know, the use of tools like whatever, Windsurf, Cursor, Claude Code, whatever it is, do you feel like that, or what impact do you think that might actually have on traditional code review? And I don't mean just from a security perspective, I just mean that could be QA, that could be other engineers.
I mean we've seen these cycles in the past where new technology abstracts out older techniques and older patterns that leads to changes in the job market, right? And so that's what's going on right now. But that also means that expertise in knowing how that technology worked and what, and how to go at and analyze code, assembly, whatever it is going to be an advantage in the future, right? So if I understand how an LLM or how someone is vibe coding and how they put pieces together, it's going to be a lot easier to break those pieces or to identify flaws that maybe an LLM couldn't find, or to actually point generative AI at risks that it wouldn't normally consider, right? It's one thing to ask ask ChatGPT to, you know, identify the OWASP top 10, because we understand that. We know what authorization issues look like. We know what cross-site scripting and SQL injection looks like in code, in a running application. It's another thing to know how to adjust your thinking to go after the edge cases, right? What fuzz databases you should be using, what context you should be adding to an application and the way it was built in order to identify those flaws. So, my short answer there is basically, it's not going away, right? We want to upscale our own ability to do these sorts of things, and AI will give us that ability, but we still need to understand the underlying technology in order to secure it properly, right? I just don't think like the vibe security, you know, if we talk about it in that way, like vibe coding, I don't think that vibe security is going to replace consultants. It's going to enhance consultants, but we still have to have that base level understanding. I don't know. Is that what you're seeing in the market? Is that what you feel? Or, how is it that you're approaching it now?
I have more questions than I have answers, honestly, right now. The reason we were late on the podcast for those listening was, we were talking through, I was kind of just saying what my company does is what I believe to be the next wave of how you secure your software. And because of that, I get to see, I guess, how real time, it's kind of interesting, real time, I have some hardcore dedicated champions of the product, right? So I get to see them, like I was telling you, change sort of their SDLC processes. And I'm kind of witnessing, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm witnessing shifts in how people are securing software real time and also producing the tool, one of many tools that's helping move that direction. But I don't even myself know all the ways at which things are going to change or how people are going to use these, I say tool, but it's a set of features and tools that provide. It's capabilities. It's just capabilities. That's all it really is. It's capabilities we didn't have before. And how that's affecting people's approach, it's different, and it's hard to sort of just, for me right now, I'm in this weird world where it's like I'm just sort of learning more than I am. Like, I'm offering up capabilities and then learning how people are going to be using those, I guess, is maybe the most succinct way to say it. It's hard to like, it's hard to really explain, but.
Well, so is this a shift in like mindset of tooling that you're struggling, that you're fighting against? Is a shift in just like, AI antagonism, yeah. Right? Like what is it?
It's not even, it's not even like a fight what I mean is like, in developing a tool that has new capabilities that never existed before, I am seeing like, and you know, that's because of the underlying technology that exists that we were able to incorporate. And I'm seeing how people are shifting the way they do business internally. Using that kind of tooling, it does, like, when you have basically, like, if you have the ability to see, like, I don't know, just take one of our features, like Insights, for instance, where you can see like all your changes for the last 24 hours that had something to do with security in some way. Like, maybe you added some API endpoints of some importance and criticality, and we surface that to you, right? Like, how people then adapt their program, having the ability to see new things, like, because there, now you're dealing with more like the releases process. And the things we've talked about before were like, things don't get put into the releases process for one reason or another, they don't qualify or whatever. And so like watching, basically what I'm saying is, like, I'm watching things change real time in application security / product security. I'm also watching things, not even like from my tool, but because of just the ability that I have to see what's going on in different shops and working with their developers and, you know, being able to communicate with them. I'm seeing the other side too, where developers are using more and more AI integrated IDEs or just different tooling in general related. And so the PRs can be very sizable. That's one impact I'm seeing. More frequent pull requests for sure, no question. More questions than answers when I see things like this. It's like, okay, well, how well are your, like, obviously you have to have automations in place, so how well are your automations? I'm not even, again, forget the security aspect of it for a second, just functionally, like are you relying on your linters? Are you like, how is there something that's pointing you to like where, as a engineer who's doing a functional code review, where like you might need to go and take a look, or where there might be a hotspot? So like, for instance, you know, I'm seeing there's tools that are similar from a functional perspective to ours, that's a security perspective, that are helping developers in that way. I'm also seeing what was the other really interesting one that people, so now, like, for instance, with GitHub, I don't know if you've tried it yet, but they have this beta feature where you can go and assign an issue to Copilot, and Copilot will go and open a pull request and fix it for you, whatever the issue, or like try to orchestrate fixing the issue. And you can kind of watch what it's doing and literally watch its like thought process and all that. They've kind of mirrored the actions view on GitHub to look like, they use that interface to actually show the output of Copilot doing its thing. So I am seeing the use of that now. But I'm also seeing folks who are like pushing back and rejecting it and saying, no, this adds more problems for me than it does help, right? It does, like, I'm having to go and fix code that was broken, or I spend more time. I saw an article where someone was like, I spend more time reviewing than I do actually like writing code, and I have to go back and change so much that, you know, it was suggested that it's becoming problematic for my dev flow. Like, I don't even want to use it. I know I'm kind of going off, but I'm saying like there's just so much changing right now that I am having even myself like hard time understanding exactly where the world's moving.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, one of the discussions that we had pre-podcast, you know, as we were talking, is is my world from my worldview as a consultant, right? As someone that does dynamic and static analysis, that's looking for vulnerabilities and introducing AI into that flow, the portions where we're actually able to utilize that change over time and change very quickly. It feels like a lot of experimentation, even though we are trying to operationalize the use. And mainly because things like LLMs change so quickly, a new LLM or a new model will pop up from Anthropic or from ChatGPT or OpenAI, whatever it is. And it will actually change the prompt, change what we actually have to do. But it is more efficient. It does a better job. So it feels like we're constantly in evaluation mode, as opposed to, hey, I've settled on this is the process we're going to use for the next 6 months to actually do assessments, right? It's very unsettling, I think, is what I'm getting from you, and actually what I'm experiencing as well.
Exactly. Unsettling is a good way to say it.
Yeah, because there is so much turmoil. And then, I see the possibilities there. That's what keeps me up. And actually, this is probably a good spot to drop in this article, right? From A16Z, from Andreessen Horowitz, right? And you're the one that pulled this one up. They're talking about next-gen pen testing, how AI empowers the good guys. I would agree with that. But a lot of this also is a discussion on, and maybe let me show this, is a discussion on how things are changing in the pen testing space because of AI tooling and how it's actually, how it's been done in the past and how it's going to change over time. I went back and forth because there's been a couple of articles on turning LLMs loose using things like Nmap or AMAS to go out and scan and look for very, specific vulnerabilities. But the ability for an AI to reason like a human is taking us a little bit out of the loop, right? And I'm getting ahead of myself here. I don't know if we quite put a bow on that discussion about everything being unsettling, Ken.
I would say when I say unsettling, for the longest time, okay, I'm gonna define why I say unsettling very clearly, which is this is the first time in my career in software security where it is difficult to understand where the job market is going for software development in general, whether that's, and I say that because that could be security, that could be QA, that could be project managers, that could be software engineers. I'm referring to all of, it's an all-encompassing term, software development. So I don't know where the job market's going. I don't know where the trends, it's difficult. It's a moving target every day with the trends of where things are going. There was previously, I think maybe a few years into the podcast, maybe 4 years in the podcast, we got to the point where it was kind of there's a variation of new vulnerabilities or a new framework, a web framework that came out or something like that, some interesting new thing. But it was all variations of essentially the same thing. This is the first time where I'm the way that code's written, the way that code's reviewed, the shipping processes, the internal pushes at some companies to go whole hog on AI, whereas others are completely adverse to it. The privacy standards, which are I can give you an example. I mean, one of the people that we were dealing with as a potential customer, they were you have to use our LLM, right? We're like, okay, well, what LLM are you using? And then they're like, we're using AWS Bedrock. And at that time, that was what we used too, right? Now it's more complicated than that and distributed. But anyways, my point is they were like, yeah, but you still have to use ours. Like, why, right? So like kind of new regulations that come out from companies that just don't really make much sense because they don't even, they're still themselves grappling. So you've got like GRC and legal and privacy and all these things that are now trying to tackle this moving target. Funding is obviously impacted in large ways, right, by this whole technology shift. And it really just fans out into this is the first time I've seen in forever where like everything is upended in every avenue. And I am, so when you say unsettling, I'm like, yeah, I can be very clear about that. It's like, nothing feels like it's ever going to be the same again. And I don't know necessarily where it's all going. And I don't think anybody does. And I think if you think you do, like, come on the podcast, tell us, because I mean, you're more confident than I am for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, at times too, right? Like, I know the name of the podcast is Absolute AppSec. The last 2 years, it's almost like Absolute AppSec and generative AI, right? Like,
right, yeah.
Because we are seeing these trends. So specifically in this article, like, you know, why traditional pen testing is no longer enough, because you can use AI to supplement, to enhance, to make things better. And, you know, to go back to the training discussion, you still need to understand the underlying technology, the underlying, you know, purpose behind penetration testing, the vulnerabilities, how they pop up, how they're actually exploited. You know, I can foresee a day where we may not understand that as well as we do now. And it doesn't mean, you know, to their point that pen tests are obsolete. It's just, we're overdue for a change, you know? And so like this statement here, right? Long overdue for something more continuous, more contextual, and more in tune with the pace of software today. I don't know if there's anything else to really say to that outside of that. This article is, yeah, go ahead.
No, there is something to add, which is like what we were talking about before the show, which is like that understanding that we've got capabilities that live somewhere between. So like back to this article, but just also the overall arching theme, which is like, we want to tie this together cleanly. All right. Probably the best way to say it is that what I said to you, which is that right now you can think of anything that we're putting into place that is backed somehow by an LLM as not being a complete replacement for a human, but for sure a huge upgrade from like the basically linting tools that we've been working with. Cause you could even kind of argue that a DAST is a linter in a sense, right? They're all very basic. Yeah. It's like response body length, response body code, response body, you know, time. It's all heuristics based off of the shape of the response, for instance. Based off of what you're putting into the request. And then, so that's the dynamic side. And then the SaaS side was, yeah, it's just straight up linting, right? I mean, even the most powerful like CodeQL is still at the end of the day linting, right? It's offensive for me to say that, I'm sure, to the authors of CodeQL, but when you really just boil it all down, that's really what it is. It's a map so now we have something that lives in between those two worlds, which is that's where things are getting very interesting, because it's like, the expectations around what it should be able to do. I mean, the expectations around what it can't. And then understanding that like you're going to get different sort of outcomes from going from this blended world of the two extremes before, where you had really smart, you know, consultants like yourself and your team doing really smart consulting things, and then just acknowledging that the tooling itself, the automations itself, is just going to be like really dumb, right? It's super dumb. Even the smartest one of those tools are really dumb, but whatever. It's like, that's our blended approach. Try to find some easy red flags in automation as things ship or being developed, and then, you know, have a human being go back and do a larger review. And now, like I said, we're somewhere in between, and people are struggling to understand like expectations of like, I expect it to do this in this way. And that's how, and like, I baked all my processes around tools that do it in this way. And now I have to like shift out of that. If you are going that route, right, and you're choosing to use something other than the like traditional tools. And I feel like I'm blabbing, but I'm not. Like, if you really listen to what I'm saying, it's like that whole like living in the middle between those two extremes uncovers a whole different type and leads to a whole different type of a set of outcomes, we'll say.
Yeah. And actually that fits pretty well with Robert's comment here that he, you know, he feels like depth of experience will become more valuable because of the complexity of systems will increase. And that's absolutely right. Like, we're living in a different, we've shifted our context discussion and our viewpoint from, we have all these disparate tools, we're only scanning once a year, to we're doing continuous scanning. You know, the, you know, things are changing, you know, over, you know, constantly, right? So we can't view our testing as an isolated experience. I mean, you know, we've had this whole like shift left strategy, but it's always been, we're doing the same things just more frequently in that SDLC. But now with generative AI, with the tooling that we can put into place, that's going to become more effective to actually cover security and other development issues. And we have to understand exactly what's going on there in order to secure those, you know, secure those tools or direct them in the correct manner. Right.
Yeah. You're directing, actually what you just said is direct. Okay. So like, for instance, with the tool that I'm building that I've been talking to you about, well, what is that really? It's driven like a person with explicit person-based and backed knowledge base and process and, you know, do this, do that. And it's all, but like to have done that requires the 2 decades of experience that I've spent doing code review, right? Like that, you know what I mean? Like, so I agree with Bobby or Robert because it's like, yeah, yes, I have a more powerful tool. That thing's pretty useless though, if I don't, or it's mostly, it's not great if you don't have the experience on how to drive it. So there is that. But can I just speak real quick to the whole, I suspect maintenance will be interesting long-term, because I actually have like, anecdotal, but it's my, so as I was building this tool, you know, it's a prototype, right? I hand it off to developers to make much better. So I'm comfortable with vibe coding up a prototype, but Here's what I experienced. So like the first thing I noticed is that the patterns aren't always repeatable. So meaning like I might have 6 things that do different things, 6 files that do different things, but in a similar way with this, like they all kind of, basically you could take boilerplate, apply it to all 6 different files and then just change things inside of each one of those files that are unique to why you have that file/class. Right. So, but the patterns that I noticed is like, they don't, like maybe on a Monday, if you did 3 out of those 6 on a Monday, like the patterns that day might've been great, or it might've been just like task-based. Right. So like within a window, I said, do these things. It wrote half of those and they followed the same pattern. The next day I go back and I want to continue on. Well, the boilerplate would be off and things would not, the patterns would not be followed. Why is that interesting? Because from a maintainability perspective, that actually ended up causing some issues. And I caught it before I actually accepted the code changes. So I realized what was going on, but that's because it was like a wall of text, right? So it actually took quite a bit of review to make sure that, and to realize that the patterns weren't being followed properly. And so this wasn't repeatable, long-term maintainable code. And then it got worse from there at times where I would ask for maybe nothing large, but it would maybe like maybe the previous context of the conversation was fairly large. So then proceeding on to a task that's a fairly discrete task, but it's following along the same history of that conversation, that context. And when a context window reaches a certain length, it seems to skew things negatively. And so I noticed that if I started a new conversation, right, and I went and I did that thing and I said, make sure you follow patterns, make sure you do this. Basically, if I directed it very, very well, and then I reviewed very, very closely, okay-ish outcomes. But if I just said, like, you know, here with this large blob of history from our chat and like this new discrete task, go do it, it wasn't, there weren't great outcomes. So there were other weird things where it's like, architecturally, why are you creating this new function when a similar function exists, right? Different name, but same kind of functionality. And in one case, it actually created the same function and overwrote the same function name that was in there. So it created the same function twice. Its function it created was up above. So that would have been the one that the code actually like preferred and accepted and used. And in a security context, if that was a security critical function, I probably would have just introduced a pretty serious authorization flaw.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to, like I said, I've been trying to get so immersed in this whole thing that I can see more clearly where things are going, right? But like what I found is quite the opposite. The deeper I get, the more I'm like, I don't fucking know what the next 3, 4, or 5 years are going to look like. I really don't. It's wild.
It is. It is. And I, you know, even if we think back the idea of context windows, the use of MCP for, you know, allowing LLMs to go out and use tooling, right? Like that's come a long way. And we couldn't have necessarily predicted that, right? Like, yes, the larger context windows made sense, you know, agentic AI, like the whole tooling aspect was there, but you know, the explosion of MCP was not necessarily something that was on my radar. You know, I thought, oh, I'm going to just have to, you know, code all this up to give the LLMs access to various functionality. And so it's actually sped up this process of exactly what you're talking about, right? I don't know, right? Like I've seen very similar activity, especially within, you know, chat logs and the context windows. Like the longer that they get, that the AI over time almost seems to degrade from a functionality perspective or from an effectiveness perspective, especially in those coding agents. And, you know, it might just be that it is like learning the wrong thing from the history, attempting to evaluate. Who knows, right? So I don't know, man. I just don't know. I don't know where it's going to go.
I know it's impacting our jobs. I know it's impacting our friends, you know, companies and careers. I know I've seen...
Well, and this is my other question.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask the audience. I was like, yes, please ask the audience. Like, get them to weigh in here. Like,
anyway. Right. Well, and the audience can weigh in on this, right? So if you, like, if you're looking at the industry now, what's going on, how do you advise someone new that's coming into the space to... Like, where do you direct them? Like, how do you tell them this is what you should study in order for them to have a career in 5 to 10 years?
That's the thing, man, I'm certain that there will not. Okay. The one thing I'm fairly certain of is that there will always be the need for the like top 1% of, you know, or 5% or whatever of security experts, like, you know, that skill set. You'll need that. Mm-hmm. So if they're going for that, well, guess what? You better get really good at your job. And I mean really, really good at your job, which means you really need to understand the fundamentals really, really well. That will never be a bad idea to understand the fundamentals, because no matter what, that's going to take you anywhere inside of any computer science related career path. Like that'll take you really far. But, you know, I guess it's like, for me, it's more of a question of not what should I learn or how should I, but should I in the first place, right? Like, should I even move into this industry? And I think if you were to ask me, I love doing this. So it's for me always going to be a passion. And I did this, you know, meaning entered into web hacking before there was a career field around it. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any real money right? I just did it for fun. I thought it was cool. And then later there was a job and there was some money, and that's great. So for me, it's very personal. I don't care. Like, it's, I'm, you know, as long as I can pay my bills, I'll be good. But if I had to, like, now, let's say I was going, if I was looking at career options now, and it wasn't like something just in my blood, right? I don't know. Like, I'm not sure I would even recommend this to anybody, right? Like, it's been a tough job as it is. And now I'm like, I don't know. Or maybe some days I have the opposite view, which is like, this is the most exciting it's ever been, even though it's like unsettling for sure. It's also the most exciting. So maybe this is a great time to get into, like, you know, the humans versus the AI war or whatever. You know, I don't know, man. That's if I can take anything away, or if you take anything away from today, it's that I have no idea. So yeah.
Yep. We're just as blind to it, right? Like, you know, even though we are talking heads on a podcast, I like, one of the things that gives me hope, right, honestly, has been dealing with some of the interns, dealing with some people that are trying to get into the space, that are doing things just as simple as like basic Python courses, for example, right? People are still going to need to learn how to code, how to do, you know, how to look at code. We still want that functionality to be there to people to understand the basics of what's going into building an application. And introducing, you know, some of those new students to the use of AI to do troubleshooting as opposed to compilers, right? The fact that, you know, letting them step through an exercise and they're trying to figure out, you know, oh, they forgot, you know, a quote or whatever it is, and banging their head against the wall, and then introducing them to Genesis, or, you know, to one of the AI tools, and saying, hey, why don't you just ask AI to troubleshoot this for you? And, like, even to help you build it, you know, now that you understand the problem space, and them being able to increase their efficiency doing that, and realizing how much quicker you and I would have been 20 years ago if we had had access to Copilot. You know what I mean? If we had had access to some of these tools, and being like, yeah, this is going to level up their experience. But then I go back and forth, because how much of our expertise comes from banging our head against a wall and having to figure out the nuances of code in those situations? And I think we don't know that yet. Like, what is that fine line? What is that, you know, how much of that is, you know, blood, sweat, and tears that we put into it, but that's the experience that we gained? And does it really matter? Do we have to go through that in order to have a real opinion or to be able to assess code? Because I would argue we don't necessarily need that. I mean, vibe coding is teaching us that.
Like, you know, it's kind of like when we were kids, right? There were no mobile devices and whatnot. So when you were bored, you had to, like, use your imagination. You used to have to, like, come up with, you used to have to be creative, right? And use your own, your own faculties to entertain yourself and keep yourself from getting bored. But now everybody has a mobile device in their hands, right? And kids don't necessarily have to live in their imagination or get creative or, you know, any of those things. They've got something that can give them that immediate sort of like, hey, I'm not bored anymore, right? I'm only saying that because I feel like there's a lot of, there are some, like, parallels and overlap with that, in the sense that, like, we did, to your point, we didn't have the easy route. We didn't have an easy thing in front of us to help us get through that. And so then it pushed the boundaries of, like, our ability to troubleshoot complex scenarios, learn new information, learn how to learn. There were a lot of benefits, as I think about that kind of fall out from that hardship. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you do talk about speed, though, at least for the, it's kind of interesting, because it's like, did that initial, quite the opposite of being quick, more so like literally having a book like open on a stand on my desk while I'm on forums, like Ruby forums, like yep. circa 2007, trying to get answers to why this like for loop doesn't work correctly, you know, beating my head against the wall. That was a very slow process, but in the long term, did it make everything else go faster? You know, after that initial hump, once I understood how to learn, how to find resources, how to troubleshoot, did that accelerate other parts of learning and adaptation and efficiency in my later career? I don't know. I can tell you from a pure writing code perspective, for me, it's been phenomenal because there are times where I, like, this is maybe a different side note I should mention, but I've mentioned before, like, the writing aspect, how it gets me over procrastination with writing tasks. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with code. It's the same with code. Like, I've been doing something like we've been talking about, it's very complex. There are moments where I'm like, oh God, this is going to be one of those things where I have to really think through it, but I can instead commit my code, create a new branch, and just say, screw it, let's experiment. And that unblocks me so much more.
Much quicker. Yeah.
So I could learn quicker in a sense and like write code quicker and get up to speed maybe a little bit quicker and just get better answers if these systems existed. But to your point, how reliant would I be on that? How like good would my troubleshooting skills be? How would I know how to learn? How would I understand the process? How would I be able to drive those systems in the correct way versus like just relying on them pre-built with how they're pre-built? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well,
I think you have a good point. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Robert's got a good point here too, right? Like the fine line is the difference between knowledge and experience, right? So knowledge tells you what to look for, but experience influences how to actually look for it, right? So your experience is what you're using to drive the AI, to drive Copilot, to drive the code generation. Knowledge says, oh, I know I can go and have the tool do that for me, but it doesn't necessarily influence how you're actually driving it. And you know, that experience over time, I think, will get better for people coming into the industry. But yeah, I still go back and forth, right? Like, where do I tell people to go? Because I'm seeing a world in which we don't need junior analysts on a SOC, right?
Yeah.
Because that sort of analysis is going to be taken over by AI, and it already is going that direction. So it used to be, you know, a computer science student coming out of, you know, college or whatever. It's like, hey, I want to get into security. They could go work at a SOC for 6 months to a year, learn, you know, the ins and outs of like how to do the analysis, what they're looking for, what they would be interested in within the realm of security based on the alerts that are coming in and what sort of, you know, problems and attacks are being driven and upgrades and everything else. And then they could go off and decide, oh yeah, I want to program, or I want to go do X, Y, and Z, or I'm really interested in account management or identity, you know, those sorts of things. But that's no longer the case. You know, like, yeah, it's hard.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know if I'm coming into this industry, like, I don't know what that looks like. Right. I mean, yeah. I really don't. I'm not saying that there's not room for it. I'm not saying that that's, I'm just saying that and maybe it's not even like immediate today. Right. Cause like, again, I'm watching this all shift real time. I feel like what I actually feel like is like, I'm lucky enough to get to witness it firsthand as there's this, I guess we know that it's happening. We're present and mindful that there is this massive change. No question. And I feel very personally lucky to be a part of viewing how it's impacting people's internal defense plans and processes and whatnot And at the same time, I feel that sense that you're saying, which is that that term you used is so correct, unsettling feeling that I have, that which is just, what does this look like in, I mean, forget 10 years, but yeah, in 10 years, but like, even in 3 to 5, where are we going here? I'm not saying like, I think there's not going to be, you know, of course, there's still going to be AppSec. There's still going to be developers. I still believe that. But yeah, just the way that everything operates what I'm trying to say is what we've been accustomed to for a couple decades, we're witnessing that change, and where that goes is anybody's guess, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, everybody will tell you that they've got the answers, and you know, I'm sure there's plenty of investment firms that also claim to have all the experts on staff that can tell you where things are going. But yeah,
exactly. I mean, it'll be scaled and right. Like, we are seeing a shift to AI first tooling. That's what we're investigating as well. You know, just to be completely frank and honest about it, because that's where we see the world going, right? If we don't understand how to use these tools, then we're going to be left out of the next round or the next couple of years. Like, pen testing is changing, code review is changing, dynamic testing is changing, consulting in general is going to change. And people are going to come to you with, you know, because of your use of AI, as opposed to because of your, you know, just strictly your expertise. It's how you're going to apply that over time. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, at least it's not, at least today's take isn't nihilistic. It's just sort of like, I don't know, there's a lot that's changing, and where it goes is going to be very interesting. It's fun to pontificate. And I know that I'm witnessing every day shifts, but I don't know. Like, it's cool. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see where it goes. What else did we have? Because we did have like other articles, like, I went similar to the conversation we've had before about breaches. Like, I went through all the newsletters and articles, and sure, there's definitely plenty of breaches to talk about. But I actually thought your "Make Self XSS Great Again" was kind of a funny title. I didn't get too far into it though. So
let me share that one really quick. I can't remember where this one popped up, if it was one of the forums. I don't think it was TLDRSec. But like, the interesting thing here, and this is completely switching topics, to be honest, right? Basically somebody identified self-XSS, right, within a bug bounty program. In general, self-XSS is one of those issues that is out of scope, right? Like, a bug bounty program is going to tell you, oh, this is out of scope, because it's only affects the user that is, you know, logged in, right? And you have to do it to yourself. But what, you know, the law of unintended consequences, as we try to make browsers more functional, right, is we introduce security risks over time. And this was incredibly clever. Let me actually show it here so we can talk through what they actually found. So this is Slonter, right? Like, you know, there is this new function or this new flag on iframes that's actually called credentialist that will strip cookies and any headers when it makes a call to a specific source, right? Like, as it's loading an iframe. The problem here is that if there is XSS, even if it is self-XSS, if from a credentialist perspective, that it doesn't take into account that it's within an iframe, it'll actually have access to the full DOM. And, you know, that's what they show up here, right? Like, XSS executes the following code. You see, you know, hi from credential list, but it still allows the access again, because of the CSP, right? Like the content security policy says, oh, it's on the same host or whatever it is. You're allowed to access whatever is in within that scope. And all of a sudden, yeah, you have access to the credentials and everything else that's there. And they, you know, they step through quite a few other, you know, different attacks there, right? CSERF on the login page, whatever it is, right? Like this XSS payload. And they do a pretty good job of breaking down what happens. But it's all because we introduced this new flag on iframes that was credentialless, and we didn't quite consider all of the security implications. Again, law of unintended consequences. Makes self-XSS great again. This is great. This is something that you should be looking for. And I always love these edge cases when they actually pop up, because it does show, it shows really good research, number one, right? But it also shows that we don't always think through the security implications of new features. And even, you know, even Google, even Mozilla, as they're, you know, they're putting these sorts of things into place, they don't always have it together. People are people, right? And we're driven by features in the development world, not necessarily by security. And so, like, this is why AppSec will always be a thing.
Yeah. I think it's pretty interesting that, like, the whole intention was to, like, sandbox off that credentialless iframe, but then as long as you can send a post message to it from the attacker iframe essentially, then you bypass any of the same site cores protections because they don't exist, because it's a sandbox, because it's supposed to be a credentialless iframe. So that's really interesting. It's like we tried to make this smart and secure, but we forgot that, like, you know, having access via the top level iframe via the post message. Yeah, I mean, can you still I'm going back to the traditional AppSec roots here with post message. Can't you still do like a, how would that work? Yeah, you couldn't do a, because you know how you can verify the sender and receiver on a post message? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking like, oh, maybe that would be, but something there. I have to think through how that would work with this. But yeah, that is really interesting, yeah.
And they, they drive through like quite a few different scenarios here, WebSockets, playing with WebSockets, right? With the login, like bypassing CAPTCHA, doing click jacking because you can actually overwrite, the page itself. And, there's all sorts of fun things that they actually take advantage of. They're just exploring kind of this ability within that credentialless iframe and what it has access to, and the way it can communicate back and forth with the other frames and the top level frame that has, allowed its creation. So, yeah. Yeah. Never get tired of post message phones. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's perfect too, because that used to be so annoying when people would say like, well, it's, you can only XSS yourself, so like this doesn't matter. And it's like, dude, security is a layered thing. I get what you're saying. You know, you'd have to go through the rigmarole of explaining this, that, or the other. So I don't know, stuff like this always makes me happy when stuff I've spent years, and I know you've spent more time dealing with that than I have, where people push back on things. It's like, it's funny one day when someone finds a way to make that thing really, really powerful and actionable.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So like, save this article for later when someone asks you why self-XSS matters.
This matters. Yeah. Yeah. Because again, layered security, like you're saying, one control within your security chain fails and self-XSS becomes regular XSS and they can exploit whatever they want. Right. Yep. post message, protocol confusion vulns. Yeah. Cool.
I don't want to steal. All right. I'm gonna put a pin in this because I actually think I might try to convince Pete on my team to release a blog post that he's been talking about, or like maybe even come on the podcast or talk or both. But he's got some interesting theories about like with MCP servers and IDEs and agentic AI and all that, like where the future of actually like web browsers might go if they're gonna still be around in the same way, and how searching and browsing in general is changing. And so like that's another, add that to another, I'm gonna put a pin in that.
Okay.
Add that to another like ramification of what changes potentially as we mm-hmm. go further down this road. So
yeah. Yep.
But yeah, anyway, so just it's interesting because Robert had brought up like different protocol confusion vulns, and then I started thinking about, well, yeah, like browsers are getting, you know, more and more feature rich and robust and offering more and more, and naturally this, that, and the other is going to happen. And then I was like, wait a second. Yeah, but will browsers really be like much of a thing someday, and how will they look? But anyways, I don't want to say, again, I don't want to steal Pete's thunder. He's got some really smart thoughts there.
So sweet.
Trying to get him public about them.
Yeah. If and when he posts it, let us know. We can have a discussion about it. Otherwise, we have been going for about an hour. I know we didn't make it to everything. There's some other links that I'll include in the newsletter. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, please do so. We summarize the I'm trying to spell at the same time. We summarize the weekly episode. And then also include extra links and a few other things that we've been thinking about, news.episodeappsec.com. And yeah, but just, if you can't catch the episode during the week, or you just want a quick summary of it, that's a good place to go. We've been doing that for, a few months now, right? Summarizing all that data. All right. I think that's everything for this week, Ken. Anything else you want to highlight before we call it?
Yeah, just if you've got people that you think could use code review skills, just know that we've got two courses. We've moved our course to July for the virtual two-day format, manual secure code review, but AI enhanced. And then we have a longer... is it still 2 days at DEF CON in August, or is it longer? I can't remember.
Yeah, okay, yep, that's still 2 days. DEF CON.
But that's more of like tackling your AppSec program needs with AI. So just that's at DEF CON. If you're going to be there and you want to attend training, you can go and sign up at DEF CON's training site. But anyways, that's the only thing I'd probably add.
Yep. And we do have some other opportunities coming later this year that haven't been posted yet. We'll let you know when they are actually available, because there is going to be some travel involved. There's going to be other places in the States, and a new combined course is what we're going to run. I'm looking forward to that. I'm actually really excited, both for the LLMs one, for Practical Secure Code Review. We love giving these trainings, so please attend if you can, or share the word out if you know of anyone that is looking for those sorts of trainings. All right, great. Well, thanks for everyone. Thanks to everyone for joining today, and we will see everyone next week.
All right. Thank you to the listeners and viewers.
Thanks all.